Welcome to you all to this joint Berkman Lunch and Circus and Science Commons sponsored event. It's a great pleasure to introduce Peter Suber, and I'll do that in a moment. I'll just mention, after the introduction, in keeping with the Berkman tradition, we can have people just say who each of you are, your name and your affiliation, so we can get a sense of who's here. I'll also mention at this time that we're videotaping this talk, and also this afternoon at 5, Captain Candy's talk, to be placed on the Berkman and Circus websites. So you may want to keep that in mind as you consider questions you might want to ask if there's something you don't want to publicize to the world, and act accordingly. But let me proceed now to the introduction of Peter Suber, who really needs no introduction. He's one of the leading lights, perhaps the leading light in the open access firmament. He started as a professor of philosophy at Earlham College, but got interested in the impact of the internet on scholarly communication, and through his open access newsletter, became the central information source on open access. His expertise has led to his current position, multiple positions, including open access project director at Public Knowledge, a public interest advocacy group in Washington, D.C., focusing on information policy, and senior researcher at SPARC, the Scholarly Publishing and Academic Resources Coalition, among other roles that he has. He was the principal drafter of the Budapest Open Access Initiative, the document that defined open access as a movement and not just a good idea. We're privileged to have him here today to speak with us on what universities can do to promote open access. Now, having introduced Peter, why don't we turn to the other people in the room, and you can say who you are and what your affiliation is. We'll start over here and work our way around.
Hi, I'm Caroline Nolan. I'm the Berkman Center staff.
Miriam Smith,
Berkman
Center staff.
I'm Michelle Seba with the writing program.
Jonathan Brown with Harvard Magazine.
Michael Fisher with Harvard University Press.
Paul Bettino, work in the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences on the Entrepreneurship Center.
I'm Amar Asher, Berkman Center staff.
Mike Dean, Berkman staff.
Matt Cockrell from Biomed Central.
My name is Marguerite Avery. I'm with the MIT Press.
Catherine Candy. I'm Executive Director of Strategic Publishing and Broadcast Initiatives at the University of California Office of the President. And I need a fold-down business card. My entire title.
Jean-Claude Guédon from the University of Montreal.
Mélanie Giron, Berkman Fellow.
I'm Seth Young. I'm staff at Berkman Center.
Becca Tabaski, staff at Berkman as well.
Harry Lewis, Professor of Computer Science at Harvard and a Berkman Fellow at the moment.
Gosha Sturgis, Harvard Business School Knowledge Programs Analyst.
I'm Bob Darnton, Director of the Harvard University Library.
Karen Nips, I work at Houghton Library, which is the rare books and manuscript library for HCL and the University.
I'm Tim Pierre, I'm a Harvard undergraduate.
Colin McClay from the Berkman Center.
I'm Mike Carroll, I'm a law professor at Villanova and on the board of Creative Commons and Science.
John Wilbanks from Creative Commons, where I run the Science Commons Project.
Leslie Chan, University of Toronto.
Terry Fisher, the faculty director of the Berkman Center.
Hey, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
First, congratulations to the Berkman Center on its 10th anniversary. It's been inspiring to me. And thanks to Stuart for his inspiring victory at the Harvard Faculty of Political Sciences. I'll have more to say about that, but I hope it reverberates, and I expect that it will. And it's all due to your hard work in educating the Harvard faculty about open access. As I'm going to point out here, one of the obstacles facing open access is that most faculty don't know much about it, and what they do know tends to be misinformation propagated by publishers. And so the obstacle is to get them on the right track, and your patient campaign did that at Harvard, and the success is showing that unanimous vote. Stuart wanted me to talk about what universities can do, but not specifically what Harvard can do. So this will be more general than what Harvard can do. And for this audience, I'm going to presuppose the basics and not define open access and not go through everything. But I'd be glad to go back over that if you get it, if you'd like. Let me just start by making sure we're on the same page with this distinction. There are two primary ways to deliver open access to journal articles, peer-reviewed journal articles. You can do it through deposit in a repository, like the one that's coming to Harvard, or you can do it through journals. The chief difference between them is that repositories don't provide their own peer review, although they will accept peer-reviewed articles as deposits. There are lots of other ways to deliver open access, and I won't talk about many of them, but I will talk about open access books a little bit. This is my outline, and my plan is to say more about number one than about the others, but to say something about each so that we can have a discussion at the end. And I want to say just enough to get that discussion going. My favorite part of the talk is going to be the Q&A, because that way I can optimize the talk for the people who are in the room. By the way, I hear that this is the kind of crowd that likes to interrupt with questions in the middle of the talk. I like that, so don't hesitate. Here's where I begin. Open access is under the control of authors. And when we talk about universities, that means faculty. And they decide where to submit their work, whether they're going to submit it to an open access journal. They decide whether to deposit it in a repository. And of course, the university can decide for them. But until the university does that, it's a faculty decision. And they decide whether to transfer copyrights. And these are the three decisions that determine whether there will be open access to that piece of work. That's a fact. The drawback is that authors don't tend to know much about open access. And if they do know much about it, they tend to be preoccupied with their work, and they don't want to do much about it. There are exceptions. The curve of author familiarity with open access is on the upside, but this is still a problem. And when universities are deciding what they can do about open access, this is the problem they have to deal with. They can't provide open access on their own, but they can, they can educate authors, they can assist authors, they can nudge authors. And I want universities to do all three of those. Alma Swan found that although open access benefits authors, they're largely unfamiliar with open access journals in their field. This is the kind of problem we face. Why have authors not self-archived? Most of them don't even know it exists, don't even know that it's an option for them. These two together show that those two primary ways of delivering open access to research articles are largely unknown to the people who are in control of the solution. So we've got to make these options known to faculty and at the same time give them incentives to take advantage of it. Okay, let's talk about repositories. The first thing the university can do is to launch a repository. And a repository has at least three properties to make it useful for open access. It has to provide open access to its contents. It has to be interoperable with other repositories, which means that people don't have to search over to the Harvard repository and run a separate search here. They can search in one place and search across all the interoperable repositories as if they form one grand archive. And they have to take steps to preserve their content. There is software to take care of the first two, and you need an institutional commitment on the third. Harvard is launching its repository. It has a couple already. One of them was launched by the Harvard chapter of Free Culture last year, and they deserve kudos for that. As far as I know, it's the first open access repository for undergraduate theses anywhere. They beat the university. But launching the repository software is the easy part. The hard part is filling it up. And for that, you have to engage with this problem. You've got to educate faculty, you've got to assist faculty, you've got to nudge faculty. And this is where Harvard's success the other day was so inspiring. There are a dozen universities around the world that already mandate open access through the university repository. Harvard was not the first, but it's the first in the United States, and it's the first to take its particular approach to doing it, which I think is likely to be among the most successful. It's also the first to be adopted by faculty, which I think is terribly important. The others were administrative decisions with faculty support. I'm going to mention a survey in a minute showing that faculty willingly accept mandates from their funders or from their employers. But it's still more desirable to have them come from faculty when faculty can be educated to the issues and then give their informed consent. let me digress on language for a second. I call the Harvard policy a mandate because I don't have a better word for it. When you classify policies according to their regulative force, we don't have too many words for them, and one is request. The Harvard policy is much more than a request. Many universities request their faculty to deposit in their repository. The track record for requests is very bad. Spontaneous level of compliance with requests is about 15%. Beyond request, there's encouragement, and the rate of success for encouragement is about the same as the rate of success for mere request. If we had a word that went beyond request and encouragement but stopped short of mandate would suggest coercion, I would use it, but we don't. The Harvard policy says faculty will do such and such, which is like saying they shall do such and such, which is how legislation talks about obligations. So I'm calling it a mandate. If I called it a mandate before the Harvard vote, maybe it wouldn't have been passed. But I'm calling it a mandate for lack of a better word. So if you want to challenge me on that, I'll be glad to acquiesce. I just need a better word. But today, I'll call it a mandate. Harvard's policy is likely to work because of the kind of mandate it is, not because it's a mandate. The good news is that mandates do work. They get the attention of faculty. Faculty know they have to comply with them. But still, the trick is in how they are implemented. There are two kinds of mandates. One asks faculty to deposit their work in their repository. I call that a deposit mandate. The other kind requires faculty to give permission for the university to host an open access copy of the article. I call that a permission mandate. Harvard's is the first permission mandate. It's not the first one ever drafted. The University of California was the first to draft a permission mandate. It hasn't been adopted yet, but I hope it will be adopted soon. The first mandate of any kind was a deposit mandate at the Queensland University of Technology in 2004. And the other 12 university mandates around the world are all deposit mandates. Here's a little information on the track record of requests versus mandates. These are three universities in Australia, and Australia is a good place to find the data because the Australian government requires Australian universities to report the number of research articles published by faculty during the previous year. It determines how much funding they get in the subsequent year. And that way we have a denominator. We know how many articles are on deposit in the repository. We don't know how many are eligible for deposit in the repository, except in places like Australia. So the denominator, the number of eligible articles, is the green line. And the number of faculty on deposit at the University of Tasmania in June 2005 is the red line. Tasmania had a request, but it had no incentives in place and it had no mandate. By contrast, the University of Queensland had a request and a crusading librarian who went from office to office telling people what a good idea this would be. And the compliance rate was up, but not as high as the green line. In other words, it still fell short of the full number of eligible articles for deposit. And the Queensland University of Technology, which has a deposit mandate, has a deposit rate above the green line. Now, how can they have more deposits than eligible articles? I think that represents previously published articles that faculty went back and digitized and deposited. But the crossover of the red and green lines is roughly a little bit after the adoption of the deposit mandate. It appears that not only do mandates work, they work with a lag time of about 1 or 2 years. And the deposit rate can approach 100% of eligible articles within 1 or 2 years. And in the absence of a mandate, it stays well below. If there's no crusading librarian and no incentives, but a mere request and encouragement, that seems to hover at about 15%. So the Harvard mandate is lucky to work just because it's a mandate, and evidence shows that mandates work. Now I can flesh out what a good word would suggest if I had a good word other than mandate. Even at Queensland University of Technology with its mandate, there's no punishment for faculty who don't comply. So it's not enforced or implemented through coercion. It's implemented by having a publicized expectation. This is the expectation of the university. Faculty will do this. Harvard says faculty will do this. At Queensland University of Technology, they say faculty publications are to be on deposit. There are lots of ways to avoid the word must and still convey the expectation that this is an obligation. So they work through expectations. They work through education. Explain to faculty what it means to deposit in their repository, how to go about depositing in their repository, what the benefits are for depositing in their repository, In other words, it's beneficial even though it's also obligatory. Providing concrete assistance to faculty who are too busy to do it for themselves or who need help with permissions or digitization. And then providing some incentives. There are some ingenious incentives around the world. I won't get into those, but there's still a lot of creative work being done. Notice that the creative work being done is not in cracking the whip to implement the mandate. It's in working on these four things so that coercion will not be necessary. I don't know a single university in the world with a mandate that punishes faculty for non-compliance. So I would like a better word than mandate, if you can suggest one. Because the more I use the word mandate, the more I think I'm giving a misleading impression to schools that don't yet have one, or to faculty who aren't yet subject to one. It's scary to be subject to a mandate, but it's not scary to be subject to a policy that enhances your interests through education assistance and incentive. Helping with the word.
Peter, if I can suggest something along the lines of commitment. Right. Commitment is a kind of obligation, but not necessarily one that comes with a sanction for it. So a pre-commitment, shared commitment, something.
Okay. What do we call publish or perish? Do we call that a commitment?
That is a de facto reality.
Yeah. I'd like deposit to be a de facto reality. We want to get to the place where it's unheard of not to deposit, the same way it'd be unheard of to write a good piece and stick it in your desk drawer forever. Commitment is good, but it's a little awkward for a university to say, we're adopting a commitment for you.
A factually accurate one, which may not be very inspiring, is default rule. I mean, that's basically what
you shifted the default, and you are allowed to opt out, unlike opting out of publish or perish. When I have space, and I don't need to compress this to one word, sometimes I call it a condition on the contract. So if you work here, the condition of employment is that you do this. For a funding agency, the condition of taking our money is to do this. There are a lot of conditions on contracts. If you work a place, you comply with the rules of the institution. If you take money from the funding agency, you comply with the rules of the funding agency. A mandate can still be a mandate if it has exceptions. It can still be a mandate if not only exceptions are spelled out in advance, like the Harvard policy, which allows opt-outs for reasons that we haven't heard of yet. You don't have to specify in advance all the good reasons that might suffice for an opt-out. Some good reasons are spelled out by these policies around the world. At QUT, for example, there's an exception for royalty-producing literature. That's a good thing. You don't want to tell authors of royalty-producing books that they have to make their work open access and thereby either lose royalties or fear losing royalties. If faculty make patentable discoveries, you don't want to force their hand and provide open access before they're ready to publish. But once they voluntarily publish, then you can say the policy kicks in. And by the way, I like the way Harvard provides an opt-out without trying to anticipate unanticipated cases. And it just says if you have any reason for wanting to opt out, you can still apply for one. I believe at Harvard, opt-out is automatic. At other schools that have an opt-out, there's a burden of proof. And this final survey is the one I mentioned a second ago. Alma Swan surveyed faculty attitudes and found, the first time she asked the question, that 71% of faculty would willingly, as opposed to grudgingly, comply with a mandate from their funder or university. And then the next year, she repeated the survey and found that 81%. She hasn't repeated it since then, but it looks like the trajectory is still going up. You can call it a mandate. You can even use all the coercive connotations of the word mandate. But faculty don't resent it. Faculty understand that they serve their interests, that it's part of dissemination, that it simply amplifies the kind of publication that they get through a standard journal. Some would not comply. Some would reply only grudgingly.
Can you say what the other 90% were worried about or what their reasons are?
No, I can't remember. And I'm not sure they're all itemized either. When I talk to people about depositing their work, I don't hear too many good arguments. I hear misunderstanding. And for that reason, I would bet that put on the phone as well. For people who publish works in journals, there's no good reason, really, not to put the same work on deposit in a repository, unless you're worried about the fate of your publisher. If you're only worried about promulgating your work and having an impact in your field, and having your work be taken up and applied by others, then it's all for the good and there's no loss. The trick is to get faculty to understand that. That's the part about communication. Let me digress on this for a second. The NIH adopted a breakthrough open access policy in January 2008, 1 month before Harvard adopted its breakthrough policy. And there's some striking similarities. They both occurred in the early months of 2008. They occurred back to back. Funding agencies around the world had been adopting open access mandates before NIH, but NIH was the first one in the United States. So we had the first U.S. funder mandate and the first U.S. university mandate back to back. It looks like there's some special momentum going on in this country as opposed to for open access in the whole world, which I think is also happening. There's also the fact that Harvard has the world's largest university library and NIH is the world's largest funder of scientific research outside classified military research. Both institutions will have influence in their fields. The NIH policy will influence other funder policies around the world. The Harvard policy will influence other university policies. And they both take a permissions approach. Both require the relevant researchers, grantees or faculty, to retain certain rights, namely those rights required to host those articles in an open access repository. And that completely solves the copyright objections that publishers have raised. Why do we still need university policies if we have these really good funder policies? There are three simple reasons. Not all researchers are funded by the NIH, not all funders have these policies, and not all researchers are funded. There is a momentum for funding agencies to adopt these policies, and one day it may be the case that all research funding agencies do. And I'm very optimistic about that. I wouldn't be surprised if it happened, because it's in the interest of every funding agency to do this. They are charities or philanthropies. They fund research because they think it will be worthy or useful, and if it is useful, they want it to be available to everybody who can make use of it. So I think it's only a matter of time before other funders catch on. But even if they all caught on and adopted similar policies, it would still be all that research that's not funded. And the easiest way to get to the whole class, or the greater bulk of that class of publishing researchers, is to have university-level policies to complement the funder policies. Okay, how does the university obtain permission to disseminate open access copies of peer-reviewed articles? First, why is permission even necessary, since the authors are the copyright holders in the first instance? The answer is that typically, by custom, but not by law, authors transfer copyright to publishers. And the copy that we want to put on deposit is similar to the one for which the publisher holds copyright. And so to avoid any claim of infringement, you want permission for this copy, which is substantially similar to the one on which someone else holds the copyright. One approach, which I call the dual deposit release strategy, Stephen Harnett calls it immediate deposit optional access, is to deposit without open access in the first instance, and then change its status from closed to open later on when you get permission. And the theory is publishers would have no objection to a dark deposit that isn't revealed or distributed to anyone. So the deposit itself does not require permission, only the later opening up of the deposit requires permission. And I support this policy. It's a good way to get the articles in the repository. And if the permission becomes automatic after an embargo period, 6 or 12 months, then you can actually program the repository to turn it on so you don't have to hunt people down and obtain permission later on when they're thinking about something else. There's the Committee on Institutional Cooperation approach. The CIC is basically the Big Ten universities plus the University of Chicago. They have adopted an author addendum, which is a contract modification on the standard copyright transfer agreement, and it allows the author to retain key rights. CSA has drafted its own author addendum, and it has encouraged its member institutions to adopt it. At least three of those institutions have formally adopted it, and if the others have, I haven't been able to find evidence of it. But at those universities where it's been adopted, it is apparently a request, not a requirement, that faculty use it. But at least they have one that they could use with university support if they wanted to. By the way, when they do use it, the author addendum usually has an opening sentence that says, notwithstanding any of the above, or notwithstanding anything in the publisher's version of this contract, the author retains the following rights. And then it retains just those rights necessary for open access archiving and maybe educational use within the institution. So if the publisher accepts it, it's perfectly sufficient. But if authors don't use it, it doesn't do any good. And even when authors do use it, the publisher is free to refuse it because it's a proposed contract modification.
And we can, I can tell you that the CIC addendum is going to go into the Science Commons engine.
Yep.
But the MIT addendum and the various Science Commons addenda tend to be rejected by publishers.
Yep.
And it's usually a form rejection which says, if you ever want to publish in us again, you'll retract this addendum that you tried to submit. But it seems to have the opposite impact of sort of radicalizing the faculty member saying, I can't believe I don't have the right just to put a copy of this in my university database. So I don't know how well the addenda work on a day-to-day basis, but they certainly seem to be very effective educational. and they start to negotiate, the professor begins to negotiate for the first time.
Yep.
Because they get angry over the way they've been treated.
That's good. This is an important step. For too long, faculty simply signed whatever publishers put in front of them.
Right.
Without realizing how harmful that was to them and to the scholars in their field. Universities and faculty are waking up to their own interests, and the more they do, the more they'll negotiate. And the truth is, in the big picture, journals need authors more than authors need journals. And when authors and universities wake up to that fact, they'll realize the extent of their bargaining power. But one faculty member against one journal is going to lose, but many faculty in many universities will win. So this is one approach. Merely adopt an addendum, encourage your faculty to use it. It's true that there are other addenda, especially there are three specific ones from Science Commons that have three different packages of retained rights. But I'm focusing on this one because it's from universities. Then there's the Harvard California approach, which requires authors to retain certain rights. It doesn't just encourage authors to retain those rights, but it also allows them to opt out. And then there's a way to go even beyond the Harvard approach, and I'd like to recommend this. Ohio Link is a consortium of 86 academic libraries in Ohio, and it bargains with publishers for licensing terms on behalf of all of those Ohio libraries. And it tries to include in those license agreements permission for self-archiving for all Ohio faculty. That is, it doesn't just try to maximize the rights of Ohio-based readers, but also Ohio-based authors. Unfortunately, it doesn't have any successes to report yet, but I think all universities could and should try an approach like this. The way serial purchases or subscriptions work these days, it isn't just a simple purchase. It's a negotiation for price, negotiation for terms. And as long as you're negotiating, try to get the best deal you can for your authors, not just for your readers. And when universities get large bargaining power, like Harvard, start to play the same game, I think we'll start to see more and more successes crop up. And this will change the balance of power with individual authors who are also trying to use an author addendum. It won't be necessary for individual authors to do it if their university has already obtained the same rights through this initial licensing negotiation. Basically, all the parties negotiating on behalf of this, the better, especially those that have more bargaining power.
This sounds very important. Could you elaborate a little bit on this? Do the libraries in Ohio, when they negotiate with the journal publishers, insert the clause that we're reading on the screen?
I think they turn over the negotiation to OhioLink. It negotiates on their behalf, the way Nestle negotiates on behalf of British universities. So it's consortial negotiating for the sake of amplifying the bargaining power. And OhioLink does try to insert this clause. It hasn't succeeded yet.
But Harvard has a lot of leverage when
yes.
It buys millions of dollars worth
exactly.
of journals every year.
That's right.
So we could, in principle,
do the same thing,
insert this
and
sort of
maybe with more success. That is, universities with the greatest bargaining power should try this first. And I'm glad OhioLink is trying it because it represents 86 libraries. But it's the biggest library in the world, the biggest academic library. You have unparalleled bargaining power. I'd love to see what Harvard could do here.
Okay, we'll work on it.
By the way, this is perfectly compatible with the Harvard policy. It doesn't require any revision. It's just a new way to obtain these rights on behalf of Harvard faculty who are now trying to obtain it one by one. There are ways that universities can help faculty, and I won't go into a lot of detail here. Harvard is already using one of them. St. Andrews is the first one I know of that said to authors, if you don't want to deposit in the repository, which requires using a web form and understanding what metadata are, which does intimidate some faculty, then just email a copy to one of our librarians and they'll take it from there. The Harvard procedure is email it to the provost office and they'll take it from there. That does reduce the barrier a little bit. The barrier to begin with is not very high, but anything that reduces the barrier will increase faculty compliance.
Dear?
Yes.
Technically, what it says is to provide it to the provost office.
Oh, okay.
And there's a question as to what that means. So one interpretation of providing it to the provost office is filling out the web form with the metadata.
Oh, okay. So direct deposit in the repository is a permissible way to provide.
Right. So exactly what would constitute appropriate provision to the provost office remains to be worked out.
Right. But will emailing and attachment be one of those?
That remains to be
worked. But you don't know that either. All right. Well, there are advantages to doing it both ways. The advantage to direct deposit is that it gets there with no mediation and therefore no delay. The advantage to an email to somebody else is that it lowers the barrier and might increase the compliance rate. I'd be happy with either one. MIT has devoted at least 3 FTEs in the library to making these deposits. And these FTEs go from office to office asking faculty, which of your peer-reviewed journal articles, or which articles have you published? And can we get them into the repository? If you publish them before the age of digitization, we can digitize them for you. If you transfer copyright, we can try to get permission. If they're recent, we can look up to see whether permission has already been granted as a standing matter by that publisher. But we'll take care of all that work. Just tell us what you've published, and we'll take it from there. That's an investment to devote 3 FTEs to that. But a school like Harvard could devote 3 FTEs. Public digitization and permissions speaks for itself, but not all the articles that you'd like to see on deposit are only digital, and not all of them already carry their own permission. What's nice about the Harvard policy for future articles is that when Harvard faculty don't opt out, they will certainly have permission for Harvard to distribute those. But for previous articles, the permissions might be uncertain, and those still should be in the repository, even if it's phase 2, even if you worry about that later. But obtaining those permissions can be a real headache. Okay, let me say something about journals. The first thing that universities can do to support open access journals is to help pay for them. And one way to do that is to buy institutional memberships at the open access publishers that offer institutional memberships. There is a growing number. Unfortunately, it doesn't make much sense to offer an institutional membership unless you offer a large number of journals. And so only the larger open access publishers are doing this. But when you can, help the cause that way. A growing number of universities are creating funds to pay publication fees for their faculty at the fee-based open access journals, like those at Public Library of Science and Biomed Central. This looks like a small number of universities that already have these funds, but 2 years ago there were 0, and all of these funds were started in the last year. And I think it's starting to catch on, and the universities are starting to realize this is another thing that they could be doing.
If it's any help, we're planning to do this here in Harvard.
Okay, good.
It's in the budget.
Oh, that's great. Do you have a plan to replenish that fund?
We're going year by year.
Because we don't know the future and how open access will challenge traditional journals. But one scenario that the publishers repeat whenever they can is that it will kill traditional subscription journals. The good news, in case that happens, is that it will create savings for library budgets. And I'd like to argue that the first choice for spending that savings should be on a fund like this. That is, if you do lose some subscription-based peer-reviewed journals, we should spend the savings on peer-reviewed open access journals to guarantee that peer-reviewed journals in every research niche continue to survive. If universities don't do that, then it's true that peer review is in jeopardy. Not just journals, but peer review itself. But peer review doesn't have to be in jeopardy if universities spend the savings on peer-reviewed journals, especially open access peer-reviewed journals.
Yep. Question. Do you know what the sort of substance of the policies at all of these different places?
No, I don't. No. Yeah, I don't think they've published their criteria.
I mention this because at UC Berkeley, the policy combines support for publishing in an open access journal, which in my opinion is excellent, with also paying a fee for publication of an open access article in a hybrid.
Yep.
And for those of you who don't know what that means, this is a commercially provided journal, a gated journal, that then for an extra fee will open up access to your particular article.
Right.
Which is a very different policy and could be quite insidious because it's giving yet more money to.
I agree. Those of you who are in the full workshop today and tomorrow might have seen Stuart's argument that that would be a bad policy for these funds, and I agree completely. There are a large number of these hybrid open access journals, and one reason is that it's risk-free for the publisher, and most of them do not promise to reduce their subscription price in proportion to author uptake of the open access option. And therefore, to the extent that they get uptake, they get paid twice for the same articles. And there's no reason why universities should participate in paying twice for the same articles. So while these funds are a good idea, they do have to be fine-tuned so that the money's going to full open access journals and not to these hybrids. We also just have to see more of them. Another way that universities can help to pay for them is to join redirection campaigns. Let me just explain this term. I've always argued that we don't need new money to pay for open access journals. We just have to redirect the money that's already being spent on peer-reviewed journals. We don't have to deliberately defund subscription journals. We don't have to cancel them in order to save money. But if they are challenged by the rise of open access, and if we end up saving money because of their demise or because they convert to open access, then we will have money in our hands that we can spend or redirect on open access journals. What CERN is doing in particle physics is to get publishers, libraries who pay subscriptions, research labs that generate the research, all together around the same table and say, we're already spending this much money on this many journals. Why don't we spend the same amount of money on the same number of journals, but make the journals open access? It's a great idea, and they're getting buy-in from all those stakeholders. They're getting buy-in from the libraries that pay, from the publishers that get paid, and from the researchers that do the work. CERN can do this because it has unparalleled convening power within particle physics, and there's really no institution in any other field which dominates the way CERN dominates in particle physics. But I don't think you need to dominate the research in your field in order to start this process going. It's a win-win, or win-win-win for all three of those stakeholder groups. What you really need is to get people at the same table. And Harvard is convening power. Harvard can get people to come to sit around the same table and talk about this. I think this model can spread beyond particle physics to other disciplines. It just needs to start. It also needs some time. We have to see how well the CERN project is working. Right now, CERN is in the stage of signing on members, including library members who now pay subscriptions, and getting them to agree to have their money go in a different direction. Same amount of money they've been paying, but just have it pay for something different. And they're building their commitment to the budget. And when they have enough, then they will tell the publishers, we have enough. So you switch your business model and we'll keep paying you the amount that we've been paying you before. So it doesn't yet have a track record. It hasn't yet started to work. We don't yet have open access journals in part of it. But they are on track to meet their budget commitment. And just last month, they got their first U.S. institutions to join on. And before last month, it was a strictly European operation. But not only is it likely to work in particle physics, I think it could work anywhere where the relevant parties could be brought to the same table. By the way, not only did the publishers agree to this idea, they determined in advance that it would save them money, that it would cost them less to publish as open access journals than to publish their subscription-based journals. So not only will the readers around the world get greater access, and the authors of those articles get greater impact, but the publishers will save money at the same time. You got to get publishers to realize that, and you got to get the libraries who pay to say, we'll continue to pay if you make this conversion. Another way that universities can help open access journals is to publish them directly. And the natural way is through their university presses, and I'm not listing those. These are open access journals published by libraries. And there's a surprising number. Libraries are getting into the business of publishing open access journals. And the way they do that is not to do the peer review themselves, but to have editorial boards do peer review somewhere else. And then if the university already has an institutional repository, to do the publishing side or the distribution side through the repository. So for example, at the Philosopher's Imprint at the University of Michigan, the motto is, edited by philosophers, published by librarians. The philosophers who do the editing are the Michigan Philosophy Department, which is an eminent philosophy department. They take care of all the peer review. It's not a library job. But when they have approved certain articles, they just tell the library, these are the ones we've approved. The librarians put them in the repository with the metadata showing that these have been approved by peer review. So the whole operation is in-house. And because the editors in the philosophy department and the librarians in the library are all on the university payroll. They don't have to charge publication fees. So these are no-fee open access journals. Another thing universities can do to support open access journals is to recognize them. And one way is to put their cataloging data in the library catalog. And the Directory of Open Access Journals provides data for all of its participating journals for libraries that are ready to do that. In other words, they don't have to generate it themselves. Universities can support faculty in editing and launching open access journals, not only provide them with some release time, but with some support staff. And above all, give open access journals due weight in hiring, promotion, and tenure. But I'm going to say a lot more about that since I have a whole section on it. Okay, let me say a little bit about open access monographs. And let me start by saying open access monographs have not been a priority for the open access movement because they carry the potential of generating royalties for their authors. And the purpose of open access is not to take money out of the hands of authors, but to take that special class of literature for which authors don't make any money, namely journal articles, and provide open access to it. Those are the authors who can consent to open access without losing revenue. That's the low-hanging fruit, so let's start there. But you don't have to end there, just because that's where you start. For most authors of monographs, the royalties are meager, or let's say between zero and meager. They hope for royalties, but they don't usually get royalties. They get royalties, they don't get many. And the benefits of open access could easily outweigh meager royalties. So there's a real case to be made that monographs are ripe for open access, even though there's a potential for royalties by authors. The first way to do this is through a book scanning program, and Harvard was one of the first to join the Google Library Project, and I committed for that. Since then, there are three other big ones and lots of smaller ones. The Open Content Alliance actually does a better job of providing open access to the resulting books than Google does. For example, Google texts are indexed only by Google. Google doesn't allow those texts to be indexed by other search engines. Open Content Alliance allows its digitized text to be indexed by anybody. Microsoft formerly worked with the Open Content Alliance and sometimes continues to work with them, but also works on its own. And the Curtis Book Search Amazon project doesn't have a short name yet, and I hope they come up with one. But Book Search is a print-on-demand spin-off of Amazon. And the model here is digitize books in your library, especially rare books that aren't easy to get anywhere else. And then we will make a print-on-demand copy and sell it through Amazon. And the revenue goes back to the library to help pay for the cost of digitization. This helps offset one of the disadvantages of the Open Content Alliance. When Google digitizes books, it pays the cost of digitization. When OCA digitizes books, it doesn't have the money to do that. It counts on the library to find its own money. The Curtis Book Search Amazon doesn't pay either, but it gives you the potential to get paid back through sales of the POD editions on Amazon. A nice middle course. Universities can also provide open access monographs through the university press. And a growing number of presses are experimenting with open access monographs. And the easy way to experiment is to combine open access with print-on-demand, which mesh beautifully. If you make an open access copy, you know that somebody's going to want a print copy. You know this yourself. I know I'm talking to academics. If you want to read a certain book, you want to read it in print. That's not always true of articles, but it's true of books. We love books. We love physical books. We like to hold them. We like to have them on our shelves. We like to smell them. So open access monographs tend to function to support sampling. They let people discover that the book exists. They let people discover that this book is really relevant to their research interests. But once people discover that, they want to buy a copy because almost nobody wants to read a whole book on their screen or print a whole book on their printer. And print-on-demand means you don't have to store a large inventory of printed copies. You just print whenever you feel like. So it's now easy for university presses to make dual editions, a full-text open access edition and a full-text print-on-demand edition. And here are some of the models that are already being used around the world. Several presses make selected titles open access. The Free University of Brussels provides open access to all of its out-of-print titles, which I think is a very nice first step. If you're afraid of the open access business model, at least do it with these out-of-print books. They're not out of copyright, but they're not generating any sales in their print editions. So at least try this and see if that jumpstarts their sales again. Some presses provide open access to all their new titles, including this new consortium of six European presses. And several presses have developed entire open access imprints, so they continue to have conventional monographs, but also imprints with nothing but open access. Several major reports in the past couple of years have encouraged university presses to move in this direction. The American Council of Learned Societies urged university presses to move toward open access and even to join the Open Content Alliance at the end of 2006. The American Association of University Presses urged university presses to experiment with open access. And it pointed out, as I did a second ago, that open access is not limited to journal articles. There are good reasons why it could work with monographs. And there is growing evidence, not all of it merely anecdotal, that an open access edition of a dual edition book stimulates net sales of the print edition. Again, because nobody wants to read the full blown edition on their printer, on their screen. So the National Academy of Sciences has been, the National Academy of Press of the National Academy of Sciences, has been publishing dual editions of all of its monographs since 1994, which is really ancient times in internet history. And they have reported three times since then that their experience is that the open access editions do stimulate net sales of the print editions. University presses are not overlooking this. They are looking for ways to stimulate their net sales. If a full-text open access edition could do that, let's try that. The American Association of University Presses says, that's true, let's try that. It may not work for every kind of book, but let's experiment and see for what kinds of books it does work. For example, it looks like it would not work for encyclopedias, where people only want a snippet, or a cookbook, where people only want a snippet. But it would work for a monograph or a novel in which people want the whole text or nothing. And the Ithaca Report, Ithaca is a spinoff of the Mellon Foundation, urged university presses very recently to do more online publishing and to collaborate with one another to achieve economies of scale. And that's the kind of thing being done now by this open consortium in Europe, where six university presses, or five university presses and one museum press, have gotten together to achieve these economies of scale. Okay, promotion and tenure criteria. Here's the key. Promotion and tenure criteria really create the incentives that determine where faculty submit their work. And because faculty control the volume of open access, this is the place, this is the valve that will control where faculty submit their work. I have to start by saying I'm not advocating that universities lower their standard. Universities have a good reason to reward first-grade work, to distinguish first-grade work from second-grade work, and to fail to reward second-grade work. That's good. My beef is that universities do this badly, and they end up failing to support all first-grade work because some of that first-grade work was not published in conventional places with high impact factors. Some of this first-grade work was published in brand new journals. Most open access journals are new. That's a disadvantage when it comes to promotion and tenure because new journals tend not to have impact factors computed by Thomson's ISI. They tend not to have prestige in proportion to their quality because while a journal can be excellent from birth, it cannot be prestigious from birth. And it takes time for prestige to catch up. And any criteria used in promotion and tenure that reward well-established journals and discriminate against new journals, discriminate against open access journals. But also think of it this way. There are lots of reasons why a journal might be new. It has a new business model, or it's exploring a new methodological niche within a science, or it's exploring a new topic within a science. There are good reasons not to overlook excellent work in those kinds of journals. But using the criteria that most universities now use for promotion and tenure discriminates against all of them simply because they're new, regardless of why they're new and regardless of their quality. So my plea is look at all first-rate scholarship wherever it occurs, even if it's in a new journal, regardless of why the journal is new. If you use impact factors as a measurement of quality instead of citation impact, then that's exactly what you're doing. You're discriminating against new journals. There are other good reasons not to use impact factor as a quality measurement because it's a bad quality measurement. There are reasons why it doesn't measure quality at all. But it discriminates against new journals and thereby discriminates against open access journals even when they're first rate. So don't discriminate against second rate scholarship badly by discriminating against a lot of first rate scholarship at the same time. one of my favorite ideas is for the promotion and tenure committee to tell faculty, we want to see your recent journal articles in order to review your candidacy, and we will only consider those that are on deposit in our repository. It's a natural way to streamline their work. It's not an artificial barrier for people to jump through. That policy has already been adopted at these four institutions. Until this policy was adopted by real-world institutions, I've been advocating this, and it did sound pretty radical. But it's not radical, and it's not arbitrary. As I say, it streamlines the workflow of that promotion and tenure committee. Why should they get stacks and stacks of paper when they could get a little list of URLs in a piece of email or an electronic bibliography? If some member of the promotion and tenure committee wants to make printouts, they can make printouts. But here we get all the benefits of open access, plus we get deposits. I think this would be a sufficient nudge to get works deposited, and it would not be perceived as arbitrary.
Is the requirement at these places that the article be on deposit or be on deposit and it's openly accessible?
Yeah. I don't think they distinguish, even though you could distinguish. I think these have to be open access. And for all I know, some of these also allow exceptions. I don't happen to know that, but you could implement one that did have exceptions.
As far as I understand, the National Research Council's policy applied to the staff that are hired by the National Research Council, not the people who receive funding.
That's right, because it's only staffers who get promoted. But while it's not a university, it applies the same policy in the analogous situation. When our researchers come up for promotion, we want to see their recent journal publications, but we only want to look at those that are open access. In practice, there are a couple ways to implement this. Some repository software generates bibliographies for depositing authors automatically. For some, you can simply say, send us an electronic version of your bibliography with live links to the open access copies of those articles. Okay, now a little bit about educating faculty about copyright and open access. Faculty are notoriously unfamiliar with copyright and intimidated by copyright. They don't know much about it. They don't have to know a lot about it for the purposes of open access. But these are the things that I think are most important for faculty to know that they probably don't know. They are the copyright holders initially when they write their piece. They can give away those rights, but in the first instance, they are the copyright holders. If they think open access is a good idea, but they typically sign whatever publishers put in front of them because they want to get published, they ought to realize that doing that gives the open access decision to the publisher, and the publisher has its own reasons for saying no rather than yes. If they want a yes answer, they should exercise their right as copyright holders before they give it away. About two-thirds of subscription journals already give blanket permission for open access archiving, sometimes with restrictions. But the remainder will often give permission with a case-by-case request. Until 2004, this was the practice of Elsevier. Elsevier did not give blanket permission at all, but whenever an author asked, they routinely said yes. And I think one reason it was easy for them to move to blanket permission was it was easier bookkeeping. People aren't going to be bombarding us with requests. Let's just give blanket permission. At the same time, we can maybe get those open access advocates off our back. If you ask a journal that doesn't typically or by default give permission, you might get a yes answer. And there's no harm in asking. I think many authors who have an article already approved by peer review are so eager to get it published that they're afraid to ask for any modification of the contract terms. There's no harm in asking. At least try. And if you don't know what to ask for, because you don't know enough about copyright law, there are experts who can help through these author agenda. Now, educating faculty about open access is a little bit different. As you saw from the earlier slides, faculty tend not to know what open access journals exist in their field. They tend not to know even that self-archiving is an option. This is why it's so inspiring that the Harvard faculty vote was unanimous. It is possible to educate faculty, and it is possible, once they're educated, to find them give a unanimous vote. That gives hope to all of us who are trying to educate faculty. Faculty have to understand that open access does increase their visibility, the retrievability of their articles, the audience, their usage, and their citation impact. There's a large number of studies now on the impact advantage of open access articles. At the very least, open access is correlated with higher citation impact, there's a lot of debate about whether that's also causation. I think eventually it will become clear that it is causation. If your work is available to a much larger group of people, then the subset that goes on to cite you will also be larger. And it's the fact of the enlarged audience which leads to the enlarged citation impact. But at least there's a correlation. Faculty should know this. Faculty, at least in the sciences, know that citation impact is one of the criteria for contract or for a career advancement. Even faculty who understand that these benefits are real don't often connect them to their own case. They don't often see how it builds their careers. That's part of faculty education. I think a lot of faculty who hear about open access think it's one of these good causes that's merely charitable. It's good for other people. Somebody's asking me to make a sacrifice to help other people. That's partly true, because every time you make your work open access, you help your readers. But it also helps you and your career, especially insofar as it helps build citation impact. It gives you a larger audience. It gives you a larger number of citations. And there's a strategy to faculty education, and I'm not the expert here. Stuart Cheever's the expert. I think faculty have to persuade faculty to do it. Librarians know all about the issues, but librarians will not be successful in talking to faculty because of faculty prejudices against librarians. Administrators know a lot about these issues, but administrators will not be successful talking to faculty for the very same reason. Faculty have to talk to faculty. It has to be viral. It has to be peer-to-peer. You have to tell your colleague down the hall, I self-archived this piece, and I suddenly started getting feedback from people in my field, or my citation counts went up, or I got this invitation to a conference, or I had an invitation to submit to this invitation-only conference or anthology. Whatever it is, spread the word faculty to faculty. Those are the reports that will be credible to other faculty. This is my digest of what faculty don't know about open access that they should know. Again, if you had to cut it down. They tend not to know the open access journals in their field. That's easy to find out. The directory of open access journals is organized by discipline. You just have to look it up. Most faculty don't even know that it exists. They don't understand that some open access journals do charge publication fees, and when they learn that, it's a surprise. And they don't know where they're going to get the money, even though sometimes the funding agency will pay. Sometimes the university will pay. They also have to understand that some open access journals don't charge publication fees. The word on the street is that all open access journals charge publication fees. That's not true. A majority don't. So we've got to communicate this. There are different kinds. Faculty who have a nodding acquaintance with open access, but not deep familiarity, know about open access journals, but they don't know about open access repositories. Even publishers who should know better sometimes speak as if the only kind of open access is open access through journals. And when there's a policy like the Harvard policy or the NIH policy, which is strictly about open access repositories, publishers will treat it as if it were a policy about open access journals. And their response will be, but open access journals have an untested funding model. Well, even if true, who cares? That's not what we're talking about. But it turns out they're even wrong about that. Number five, I think, is one of the keys. Open access archiving is compatible with non-open access publication. As I said earlier, about two-thirds of subscription journals give blanket permission for open access archiving. Some faculty think, too many faculty think, that there's a trade-off between publishing in a high-prestige subscription journal and open access. And if you force faculty members to choose between high prestige and open access, most will choose prestige. I don't even blame them for that choice. The problem is framing the problem that way. You don't have a trade-off. In most cases, you can do both. If the most prestigious journal in your field is subscription-based, publish there. Chances are good that it permits open access archiving. So do both. Publish there, but then also self-archive. And again, even if you're publishing in one of those one-third of journals that don't give this blanket permission, some of them will give permission on request if you make a point of asking. The Engelfinger rule is the rule that says we will not publish work that is already circulated as a preprint. And it started in medicine. It should have stayed in medicine. It's expanded a little bit, but it's also shrunk. And many faculty are afraid of preprint archiving, that is archiving a version prior to peer review, because they're afraid that will disqualify them for future publication. And these fears are way out of proportion to the number of journals that still use this rule. The rule is a minority rule. It always was a minority rule. It's shrinking. And if your faculty member is worried about preprint archiving, they should check the policy of the journals in which they might actually want to publish. And finally, open access significantly increases citation impact. the studies on this subject show that it increases the citations by 40 to 250%, even when we control for the same issue with the same journal. And we can do this through self-archiving. If you take a journal that is not open access, and some of the articles are later self-archived and some of them are not, you compare the citation counts, those from that same issue with the same journal that were self-archived tend to have greater citations. There's a lot that faculty could be told that they aren't already told, but I think this is the short list. But now, I'd be glad to open it up for questions.
One concern that arises in the law school world, maybe peculiar to the law school world, but or may just be stronger there, is authoritative citations. So legal scholars, this is a cousin of prestige, but not the same thing, are very concerned that their publications be in a spot where they can be and are likely to be picked up. Say the court case would be by courts in recognizing their contribution to the literature. And there are these, as many of you know, documents in the legal world which codify the customs of citations. The Blue Book at Harvard and the Maroon Book at the University of Chicago are the leading ones. So they're elaborate and authoritative, and almost everybody abides by them. There's an unease about open access publishing that they will forfeit this the citation precision.
Yep.
Now, one way of dealing with that is the models of dual publication you described, so that you continue to publish your work in you know, the usual run of law reviews, you get the official citations there, and that's what people are expected to refer to. If that's the solution, however, it puts a lot of pressure on the character of the archiving. Because then the archiving, to be effective in this regard, has to be exactly what appears in the journal. The page numbers have to correspond precisely. So this may be, this is a point of detail, but it may be uneasy about your reference to substantially similar versions in the archive to the published versions. The substantially similar rather than identical standard is going to create a lot of problems for the purposes of authoritative reference.
Yes.
Okay, so that's one set of concerns. Now, a separate one is what about the more courageous or innovative scholars who forego the dual publication strategy and just go for open access publishing? One sort or another, in the extreme case, just archiving in a repository rather than publication in either an open access or a traditional journal. Is there some way of capturing those in this custom of citation systems? This may end up being in the legal world a question not so much for universities, either collectively or individually, as it is for these odd self-appointed institutions that manage the citation system. But I can definitely say that from the standpoint of legal scholars, it's a worry. So those are a few matters of detail. Some of them, I guess, for you, some of them maybe for Bob Darden and the people who are going to be overseeing the construction of the repositories that might ease the acceptance of these proposals.
I can see about three solutions. One is to make more law reviews open access. And there's good promise of that because most law reviews are owned by law schools who use them as advertisements for the quality of their programs. And they would work better as advertisements if they were free. They have tended to become profit centers because LexisNexis pays. But at some point, universities have to decide whether to follow their mission of disseminating research or simply turn these into profit centers and limit the availability of that research. But insofar as that's an option, turning them into open access journals would solve the problem completely, because then the Blue Book citation points to an open access copy. Second, a good practice is to put the full citation of the published version in the self-archived copy, including a link to the published version. So if you publish in a closed access law review, but you also self-archive a copy. Make sure that the self-archived copy says this was published in such and such a place. First of all, that helps you because it tells the readers that this was actually peer reviewed, that it's not just something that came out of your desk work. Second, it gives them the link and the citation to the article so that when they have to get around to citing it, they can go to the trouble of hunting it down in case they have to. But they can still learn about your article in the first place and discover that it's relevant to their work because it's open access to them. So you get a little of the best of both worlds. What was the third? Revise the Harvard Blue Book. Jean-Claude Dijon wants repositories to become branded the way journals are branded. There's prestige in publishing in the Harvard Law Review, and that'll be hard to match by depositing in the Harvard repository. But there's no reason why, over time, deposit in the Harvard repository couldn't acquire its own brand, its own prestige, precisely because, the only people with deposit rights are Harvard faculty or people with Harvard affiliations. That could become a brand on its own. If so, it's a citable copy. It's not necessarily the same text as the one published somewhere else, but it could be citable. Now, in the natural sciences, as you said, not the same situation as in law, but and another reason is that law reviews tend not to be peer-reviewed in the same way that science journals are. But it's usually enough for the purposes of science for researchers to get access to a peer-reviewed edition, even if it's not copy-edited, and even if it doesn't have the pagination of the published edition. Because what they want to know is whether this work confirms or disconfirms what I've been doing, whether it's relevant to what I'm doing, whether it's worth the trouble for me to find the toll access edition. You can use some of that in the legal world as well. In addition to making the repository its own brand, or having its own prestige, by linking back to the published edition, you can give most readers most of what they want in the first instance. You can make the argument of the article open access, and therefore more widely available to people doing research on the same topic. And then, if they ever did need to cite it, they could they know the citation of the published edition, and they have a link to it, even if it's online and they can't click through without being a subscriber. They know how to go about getting a copy for the purpose of pagination if they really need to.
So I can follow up just briefly on those. Those are very helpful suggestions. The only one that makes me uneasy, or an aspect of the last suggestion that makes me uneasy, is the continuation of a distinction between works in progress in the repositories and final versions for which you have to click through to whatever journals are willing to allow you to click through. At minimum, it would seem important for order and reliability in this to differentiate in the repository works in progress and final versions.
Yep.
Yes, it's wonderful to have access to your colleagues' work that work as it's developing, but you want the reliability at some point of confidence in a final version. And ideally, that final version should correspond to any other final version that appears anywhere else.
Yeah, that's right. That's why it matters that a journal might be peer-reviewed or not. In the sciences, where all work is peer-reviewed, it's usually enough to say, this may not be the published version, but it's the peer-reviewed version. And so it's the version that scientific peers have said is worthy of publication. The science is at least well done, even if we can't vouch for the conclusion. That's the one that most readers following in that field want to consult. Because there's nothing quite analogous in a law review, you can't quite say the peer-reviewed version is good enough. What you could do is label the version, and very often you can say, this is the version I submitted to a certain journal. It's published with minor modifications, and here's the link to the end result. I didn't change the argument. What the copy editors did at the other journal was to multiply my footnotes by 10, which is often the result. There are benefits to reading the final copy, but you're giving people a link to that if they ever need it. There is an emerging MISO standard for identifying the versions of articles so that you could give it a version label that would be meaningful across disciplines. And I'm not really happy with the version of the standard that's emerging, but there are all kinds of ways to label versions. The simplest is with version numbers. If version 1 is the published version, you can say this is version 0.9. get, just the version that I thought was good enough to submit, and now that it's been published, I can tell you that the substance of the argument is identical. And that may, again, be enough for the person who's only looking to see if there's relevant work being done in their own topic.
And I think it would be useful to add in the metadata two items. One should be citability and the other one peer review, including the fact that they can be dissociated, because you could have a case where the article has been peer reviewed, but it is deposited in such a way that it is not citable exactly for the reason you're mentioning, Terry. For example, the pagination has not been maintained or whatever. But you immediately would see through the metadata, including through machine reading of that, whether the article that you're consulting can be cited, can be peer reviewed, or both, and you could then proceed accordingly. Yeah.
Because I'm a strategist for open access, I often see obstacles as advantages. There's often a dilemma. Everything that looks like an obstacle is only one from one point of view, and it's an advantage from another point of view. In this case, the disadvantage of not having the citable version in a repository means that libraries still have an incentive to subscribe to the citable version, and therefore the publishers are less threatened by open access in this form. And insofar as they realize that, it sort of calls off the pounds, and you can get your open access policy into place. And then later over time, you might be able to tighten it. But the chief obstacle to open access has usually been publisher opposition. And if you can reduce the temperature for publishers with a practice that preserves library incentives for subscription, that's strategically good, even if it doesn't provide open access to the optimal edition. And then over time, you can worry on providing open access to other editions as well.
A couple of comments on, I think this is a very important and complex question. I think version control in and of itself is something that we really are struggling with, and we'll continue to struggle with even more as the sort of research and publication cycle becomes just that, more and more of a cycle than a linear process, which I think in the olden days you sort of did your research and your findings and published. I think there's more and more communication, sort of farther upstream, if you will, you know, during the sort of course of the development of an idea. And because of that, there is a proliferation in all fields, really. There's a proliferation of sort of preprints, technical reports, whatever. And we haven't really grappled well with just the version control of all of those, so we can actually keep track of, you know, what is related to what, and you know, what's the sort of final version, regardless of the commercialized published version, whatever. So just to validate that, I think that is an extremely complicated problem, and libraries are really struggling with this. But what I wanted to point out is that I think in the context of postprints being put in open access repositories where there is a published version and then there's another version, I think that problem is necessarily connected with the greater problem, which is that what we have given to the commercial publishers is not just sort of dissemination control, but certification control. It's so bound up with the fact that we've actually outsourced the certification problem or process that until we actually switch the center of gravity back into the academy, I don't think we're ever going to be able to solve this problem. I think we're stuck at that tension. We're talking about ways, and Peter, you're describing it finally, you know, ways to sort of finesse this problem, that this is the authoritative version and it's kind of going into control over here. And so there are various schemes for getting this content out and open. And I think we have to look at open access schemes as sort of necessary but not sufficient for actually addressing the broader problem, which is that the universities, have been helped for the last century by a publishing infrastructure that's just no longer capable to the task, and that there's a huge pressure on the university to take better control of the means of certifying work, such as the scholarly record, and continue. And one portion of that might be sort of outsourced certification. But that when you start to consider in that realm what the certification process is, which is based on faculty expertise, and how that is actually organized by the institution, then other problems of how you actually sort of keep track of versions and all that, before they get with a certain perspective.
Just two quick footnotes before I call on somebody else. One thing that makes law reviews special is that they're published by universities. And so there is this general problem of regaining control from publishers to whom we've outsourced publishing, but that's not the case in law reviews. And one way the NIH has dealt with the version control problem is by telling publishers, if you don't like the fact that we're depositing a different version of the published version, the published article in our repository, if you don't like the multiplication of versions, then you have the right to deposit the published version in our repository, and we will remove the other version. And for some publishers who really worry about version control, version proliferation, that detracts from the impact of their published edition, that's an attractive offer.
Peter, if I can amend that, they actually don't remove the author's final manuscript, but they bias the interface so that you'll find the published version first, because they actually want to keep track of everything that's come in and keep that record alive. But yeah, I mean, this versioning problem, if I can also suggest, if you want to keep the subscription model alive and take the pressure off publisher resistance, it's either only have author final manuscripts as the open text so that what they're selling is the citable record, or delay access to the citable record but insist that the citable record is eventually put up online. So for instance, in law, what we need to do is everybody who publishes their working paper through SSRN after it's published needs to go back and replace the PDF of the working paper with the published version. We haven't pushed that out yet, but so that the citable record is in the repository. And a lot of us do that, but it's not become the norm. But I do think, you know, you can say subscription model survives, but the citable record has to come back into the hands of the academy after a certain period of time and make that a normative goal of open access. We haven't all coalesced around that point yet, but that's something to be discussed.
I'd like to ask you about the application of the argument to monographs. I mean, it's a wonderful cause, and we need help on how we can realize it. The main argument, and I'm sure you've been through this many times, is one that's cited actually by the American Association of University Presses, even though you claimed that they were on your side. I wonder, because they claim rightly that they add value, and that you've probably seen some of the polemics about this. I mean, Sandy Thatcher, who's a very influential figure in the world of university presses, loves to make sport about the bad prose of professors, and the way editors can actually help professors to write better, aside from the business of articulating the text and improving and so on and so on. And that's not a silly argument. It seems to me it's a strong one. So my question is, how do you make the transition in your argument where you say, rightly, it's very different for journals because there the overhead costs are not so great. But when you come to monographs, the costs are enormous. And how can we help university presses make the transition to OA?
Yeah. First of all, Sandy Thatcher wrote the AAUP report that recommended trying open access experiments. He didn't say they should commit to open access, convert to open access. He just said try open access experiments. Open access might be beneficial for monographs as well as for journals. He also made this argument that monographs are more expensive to produce and they have heavier burdens of copy editing. But despite all that, he wants presses to experiment with open access. He may be banking on the growing evidence that for some kinds of books like monographs, the open access edition will stimulate sales of the print edition. So the investment that the press makes in copy editing will be repaid by greater sales. Again, that's an experiment worth doing. The NAP has really shown over more than a decade of publishing experience that it seems to work that way, at least with monographs. Presses, university presses should be trying it, maybe for the same reason. But another way to reduce costs and thereby increase the chance that you might actually get repaid for your investment in copy editing is to become an electronic first publisher, so that the print edition is a derivative of the electronic edition instead of the other way around. I think a lot of university presses had legacy overhead because they were print for so long. and they have legacy personnel, legacy equipment, which all adds up to legacy overhead. That adds to their cost. It means they have greater income to pay those costs. If you work for the open access or the digital edition first, and you make the print edition, just a print-on-demand version of the electronic edition, you might reduce all the costs from the start. It may be hard for an existing press to do, like Harvard University Press, but it means that a lean, mean startup that's electronic first and print second might have a much different economic picture. And you can put the same care and investment into copy editing and still realize revenue surpluses.
I wish you had a third argument. And there have been experiments. The University of Pennsylvania Press has done an experiment by making for a limited public their print books available online free to see whether it would increase sales. And I think the results were not clear. I want to believe that this would happen. But as in Laura Brown's report on university presses, university presses are under terrible pressure now. It's a very, very tough business. And the idea of their experimenting when they have so little margin leaves me worried. So I think we've got a real problem.
Andy Report tried to take that on by arguing as well that universities should stop trying to make university presses break even or to make them profit centers. They should treat them for what they are. They tend to be presses that publish books that are of scholarly importance that may or may not sell.
That's right.
They have to be subsidized. And if universities remember that that is the role of a university press, so that they don't turn down good work that might not sell in favor of the poorer work that will sell, then everything changes. There's more money behind each of these books, which deserves to see the light of day. But again, that depends on winning a different argument. That depends on winning a political argument within the university.
And there would be ways also to change the marketing of books, for example, by testing the market through the electronic version and seeing which ones ought to be promoted to other forms of dissemination publication, you know, including paper, which could become the luxury end product for some books.
Well, I would even add that you could do things, of course, with electronic books that you can't do with print books.
That's right.
And so
right.
They can make make money by indicating the new whole realm of possibilities that's opening up through the electronic media.
We experimented with some of this at the University of California, and I mean, you're exactly right with some of the difficulties. The base experiment was to put 2,000 University of California Press monographs up online or in XML. Well, no, actually, you're referring there to our Open Access repository. Those are PDFs.
Well, I'm talking about Open Access book series through the University Press, not through the repository.
Okay. Well, there are more than 2,000 monographs of open access, and 500 of them were out of print. The rest are available to the University of California community and not to the rest of the world. And the sales, and a lot of them, or some of them, have been course selections. But the sales went up slightly, not statistically significant, but we know they went up. they didn't hurt. But the bigger problem really is getting to the point that you suggested, which is an electronic first edition, and then the rest are derivatives, is very, very expensive, and it takes some real investment in infrastructure, and this kind of investment that the university presses don't have. And in fact, it's really a boutique service. The National Academies Press has worked because they have thousands of titles up, and they always talk about the long tail and whatnot. It was really kind of a fluke that the library was able to come up with the money to grab these 2,000 titles and put them up. So we have actually been trying to figure out how to help transform the entire process, and you know, we've been working on it for 5 years. There, yeah, we do have a number of other series that do run in the repository, where it's a distributed process where faculty can sort of propose that a monographic series is launched, and they build the editorial body that's going to review it. This is to relieve the editorial bandwidth problem on the press. And then the press editorial committee, which normally reads an entire manuscript for a book, will actually kind of vet the faculty editorial body and then allow them to acquire and review and publish sort of on the press's behalf. And that has actually proven to be fairly efficient, but it's a physically degraded copy, and it gets only a two-color cover, and everybody wants that beautiful four-color cover, you know? And I mean, it's not just the thumb factor, but they really want beautiful books. And so somehow we have to figure out how to get the efficiencies of providing a press that gives a service to research and scholarship and provides those outlets without, I think will force us into sort of tiers, without giving up some of those sort of boutique services that are still so highly prized. And I would love to hear any thoughts on how we get there without the appearance of establishing tiers, which those in the press are loath to do.
By the way, I too have heard about experiments with open access photographs that did not work. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it increases sales, sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. One reason to do the experiments is to see if we can figure out with more precision for which kinds of books it does work and which kinds of books it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And if we ever could figure that out, you could focus the experiments on the ones where it tends to work and lose less on your investment.
Mm-hmm. I have a vague long-term suggestion on this front, which would be that the organizations that are principally disadvantaged by the current distribution model of university presses, it's not the research libraries, the Harvards of the world and the Berkeleys of the world, by all significant university press outlets. It's the small colleges of the world, of which there are thousands. And specifically, the juniors and seniors in the small colleges who are writing theses and have trouble gaining access to the materials relevant to their specialized topics and have to scramble with various forms of interlibrary loan. So the small college libraries strain at their budget limitations, and they know they're never going to have the collections adequate to the interests of their increasingly sophisticated students. So that's a market for electronic-first university publication. So there is this group, if they could be organized so as to participate in contributing to a consortium that would benefit enormously. They would have to be enlisted. So if there were some way of putting together the universe of, this is all pursuing Bob's question about the presses, put together on one hand the increasingly financially pressed presses and the college libraries who have never been able to have good access to the output of the university presses, is it's in both of their interests to convert increasingly to electronic or electronic first or default electronic or optional electronic format, they would all be better off.
Indeed. And that's what we've actually, the California Digital Library and the UC Press have actually been working very closely on that problem, and we assembled about 50 people from all of the leading university presses and libraries that are working together to try to tackle those problems. And there's general agreement, sort of like open access, there's general agreement that's the correct way to go. How to actually get there is complicated. And in fact, many presses do get some sort of subsidy from their local university, even though only maybe 40% of the books actually come from their local faculties. And so they're just, you're absolutely right, and it's a non-trivial problem, all I can say. And some of it is literally technical. I mean, if we had a good capability for an entirely XML workflow that could create an archival XML file from which we could create these beautiful print editions and these, you know, much faster and cheaper electronic editions, we would be there, and we may be there in the next 2 years. We're just not quite there, and so we're caught up in all these silly little logistical.
Peter, I just want to make a comment back to this versioning issue, and just perhaps remind ourselves that this whole issue about citation and so forth is not unique because of open access. Open access didn't create this problem. Citation, versioning, and all that, we have this problem, you know, since we have scholarly communications. If I remember correctly, there's 16th edition of The Origin of Species, and the 16th edition is quite different from the first edition. And we'll always have to deal with that kind of issue. And we have, last I looked on EndNote, there are about 140 different citation styles across the disciplines. So whether you're social science, humanities, we're all different citation styles. And we all have to deal with these different way of citation, different kind of convention of scholarship across discipline. So it's nothing new that we have to deal with slightly different way of doing things. And I don't, I remind us, it was not unique as a result of open access, and shouldn't be putting it on the onus shouldn't be about, you know, open access.
Yes.
It's really about how we do things differently in the electronic environment, and we'll continue to change the way we do things in the electronic environment.
That's a good point.
Open access or not.
This NISO standard that I was referring to for identifying different versions of an article is being led by publishers. And I think they believe that once we have a standard vocabulary to refer to different editions, that it will favor the published edition. But they may be wrong. It may be that if we have a standard vocabulary, we could cite the deposited version because it has a name that everybody understands. And if we cite it, Quay deposited version, everybody knows what that means. Then it's citable as that. We're not pretending we're citing the published edition.
Yeah, to continue on that and to go back to your question of certification and recovering it within academe, it would be most likely by the next 5 years or so. Most articles will be eliciting some sort of reactions that will be also published in some wiki or some whatever. So that a repository could then decide as a general policy that its version is at least as good as the version that has been published by some commercial publisher. At least as good. By at least as good, it would mean things like we have enhanced things, we have added more information, we have more illustrations, we have better, you know, and at that point the whole issue of prestige and certification would start drifting back towards the universities, because this at least as good as would become also the preferred citing.
There's also a growing literature on the problem that copy editing often subtract value from manuscripts rather than adding value.
Sorry?
Copy editing by journals subtract value rather than adding it. Introduces errors, makes clear language vague.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, but you can't do that as a rule.
I know, but I'm saying if you could make clear which version you were citing, then suddenly the odds would be different once this literature is better understood. That you might be citing the preferred version. It wasn't copy edited by a journal, it was the well-written version submitted by the
director's cut.
There's also a growing way for technology to deal with this problem. So, I mean, if you're familiar with the Open Archives Initiative standard, the one that's coming out is called the OAI ORE, the Object Relation Exchange Standard. What that is, it's a very fancy way to say that there are many times lots of copies of the same thing on the web and things that are related to it. And so this is a way to dereference all of the comments about an article and all of the versions of an article to a single identifier, so that you'll be able to see that there are 16 versions of the article and version 8 has 27 comments on it. And so it's a technical hack that deals with some of these issues, and we'll see how well it works. I mean, it doesn't exist yet, and we don't know how well it works, but in theory, it should manage most of the complexity around this in a way that will be, I think, fairly threatening to publishers, because this will actually make the preprint findable at the same time as the postprint, and it will make it easy to track back the comments around an article as being part of the ecosystem of research. And so I think we don't know how it's going to work, but I think it's a real technical threat to some of the control that the publishers implement around exactly this issue.
I think it may be worth mentioning the case study of particle physics in a way, which has demonstrated that a sort of dual approach with the coexistence of preprints and the coexistence of peer-reviewed articles both being independently cited and being able to refer to a preprint fairly unambiguously with the identifier which it gets in the preprint. In the archive. It kind of works, although the degree of clumsiness of it is probably one of the reasons why CERN and the other physics labs are quite keen to say if we could cite a version which was the version of the article, that would have some benefits compared with the system right now, where is somebody citing the preprint or are they citing the public peer-reviewed version or some combination of the two. It's doable, and that's what we see in the papers we publish in physics these days. They have got the mixture of references to preprints and to peer-reviewed articles, but it does add complexity.
That also helps that the physics archive is the archive.
Exactly.
And while the OAI ORE is working on this feature, Google is working on a similar feature. And if you look up an article in Google Scholar, it will tend to cluster all the different versions of the same article that it can find together so you can look at them all at once if you want to. Right now, it puts the published version at the top of the list, but it also links to the cluster as a cluster. And if some of those articles have attached comments, I don't know if Google Scholar is ever going to say that they do, but it will make it easier for people to find the editions that have attached comments, because those might actually be more useful for some research purposes.
Well, and the hope is with ORE, again, to state it's not fully baked yet, so we don't know if it works, is that you can have the data sets, the research tools, the software models, the metadata, all of that could be associated with a single identifier as well as the articles. And that's, you know, and the nice thing about OAI, ORE versus Google, is that everyone gets to index ORE as opposed to only Google gets to index Google.
Right. We should wrap up. I'd like to thank Peter again for his comments.
Thank you.